This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Rather than squander the surplus on a risky tax cut for the wealthy, I would put it in what I call a lockbox.
That's our guest Daryl Hammond, portraying Al Gore on that famous Saturday Night Live skit. Hammond's impersonations of Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, John McCain, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Sean Connery, and others kept Saturday Night Live audiences laughing for a record-setting 14 seasons. Page one of Hammond's new memoir begins with his story of being sent to a psychiatric and rehab facility after getting drunk and trying to cut his arm off with a kitchen knife. The memoir, called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed, goes on to reveal Hammond's history of mental problems and childhood abuse. Hammond spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week, and as you can imagine, some of their conversation may be upsetting to some listeners.
Daryl Hammond, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, reading your book, I kept thinking to myself, I've seen you so many times on TV. I had like no idea that you were going through such agony and that you were having, you know, the mental health problems that you were having and the alcohol and drug problems that you were having. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to let us know about all of this?
Well, I think I've been fascinated for as long as I've been alive, and that's a few years now, about relationships between perpetrator and victim and the contract between perpetrator and victim, the agreement between perpetrator and victim in which the victim agrees to remain silent because he's in fear. And so I wanted to write about it. Maybe I didn't write well about it, but I wrote about it, and that's what's in this book.
When you refer to yourself as the victim, do you mean victim of your mother?
Yes, partially.
Do you want to explain the way that she physically hurt you?
Well, it's in the books. There was, systematic. I don't know if it's systematic. Hammer, electrical outlet, knife.
Sounds pretty horrible.
It wasn't too good. I've been in treatment since I was 19, and I'm 56. So that's a couple of bucks and a long time.
Yeah, you're right. When I was 5, I was overwhelmed with the sense that I was surrounded by evil. When the sun started to go down in the late afternoon, I was filled with foreboding, and everything was scary. The walls, the furniture, the rug, the very air was scary. Do you think that's because you were afraid of to be in your own home? You were afraid of your mother?
I think that's because I wasn't liked at all.
I think the story I found most surprising in your book is the night that you were preparing to do a Bush-Gore presidential debate with Will Ferrell as Bush. And this is like a really famous sketch that you did, because it's where Will Ferrell first does strategery and where you first do lockbox with Gore, talking about he wanted Social Security safe in a lockbox. Mm-hmm. So meanwhile, before the sketch, you're backstage in the dressing room, preparing to go on. The floor turns red. You forget what Gore's voice sounds like. You forget what Gore even looks like. Could you describe what you were experiencing?
I don't know if I can describe it any better than that. I mean, I was disoriented and frightened, and I was feeling every single thing that happened to me, you know, when I was in the kitchen once with my mother. And I'm not a doctor, so I can't describe what flashbacks are as well as perhaps they can, but it is like you're living it again. So if you make a small cut, it creates a new and more manageable crisis than the one that currently has you lying.
Let me stop there. You're talking about cutting yourself.
Yeah.
With a razor.
Mm-hmm.
So I interrupted you. You're saying it does what?
It creates a smaller, more manageable crisis than the one that has you gripping the carpet.
So like the physical pain distracts you from the mental agony.
I think so. I think that might be a fair assessment of it, yeah.
So did that help? Did it help you pull it together before going on stage?
It did, and then the genius writer, Jim Downey, did the line readings for me in the Gore in which we had discussed, which was sort of an amalgam of the two or three different presentations I'd seen of him. I found that he spoke differently on three different occasions, and we were confounded by that in about, you know, for about a year. And so we tried to find some amalgam of those three, so people say, well, that sounds exactly like him. Well, it doesn't sound like him at all. It seems to, but that's not him. It's an amalgam that I worked out in Greenwich Village in front of the audiences at the Comedy Cellar, which they finally began to respond to.
So let me back up a second. So did Jim Downey, who's doing the line readings for you, did he know what was going on with you?
No. No.
Did anybody
know?
I mean,
there were only really a couple of instances where people did know. I mean, most of the time it was really manageable. But if you had, you know, a pint of Remy to the occasion, then sometimes it gets a little messy.
So you go on stage.
Uh-huh.
And you do the sketch.
Yes, he says, I forget what he said, what Chris Parnell, was playing Jim Lehrer, says. And then Downey is standing right in front of me. We've been doing these line readings for about 90 minutes, 60 minutes. And I say, GM, and start, you know. And once I pulled that trigger, I was able to do it. I mean, it wasn't nearly as much pressure as I've been under in my life. It wasn't nearly as much.
Mm-hmm. So did you enjoy it once you were out there?
It was exhilarating because when I did, I think the line was something like, Jim, I was about 10 seconds into the line, and there was a smattering of applause in the crowd. And some laughter, as I think, just a little bit of laughter. And I had a sense that, wow, yeah, we've worked on this for a year. Here it is. And they're responding. And it was exactly what I wanted to happen.
Now, you did John McCain. I think it was like your last season on Saturday Night Live. And
yeah.
So you did McCain opposite Tina Fey, Sarah Palin, when like everybody was watching. But you didn't want to do McCain.
No.
Would you explain
not
why?
After,
yeah.
Well, you know, my father and I had never been close on any level for, you know, 40-something years. He was dying of cancer. He was in a hospice. And we got a call on a Saturday. I was doing a show that night with Obama, future President Obama. And I called and I said, look, I will skip tonight's show and I'll come straight down there. And he said, I think that in case this guy's the president, you should have this honor of being on stage with him. And I said, okay. So he took himself off his morphine. He's afraid the morphine would stop his liver or his heart or something. Because, you know, by then he'd had his ear cut off and really savage pain. So he takes himself off the morphine. I fly to Florida the following morning with my pal Eddie, who's ex-NYPD and who my father, I think, truly loved. And we get there to the hospice, and, you know, there's a few hours left to his life, you know. And we get there, we walk in the room, and he had arrayed his war medals on his chest. And it was as if to say, you know, I guess I wasn't such a great dad. You know? And I took that as an apology. Sorry.
You're saying that he was saying to you, maybe I wasn't such a great dad, but I was a really good soldier?
He was saying, it took my life. It took my heart. It took my soul. I went there. I became a warrior. I killed people. And I had a hard time, you know, adjusting to society after that.
So getting back to McCain, you didn't want to portray McCain because...
Well, we had a military funeral. There were soldiers. They played taps. There was a folded flag. And it was, I think... the single most... Yeah, I have to... Just give me a second.
Sure. However much time you want.
It was the single most important thing that had ever happened to me in my whole life. The single most.
That funeral?
Yes, because I realized, you know, I had seen him through the years grappling with these visions of what he called verifiable evil. I mean, maybe not biblical, but not of this earth. When he looked into the eyes of one particular Nazi officer who... God, sorry. He took his gun, you know?
Your father...
Which is...
Your father took the Nazi's gun or his own gun?
His gun, the Nazi's gun.
Uh-huh.
And brought it home.
Right.
And I guess I was about 12, and he was sitting in the living room, just hammered, you know, on gin, and staring out, as he was wont to do, into his tomato garden, through the glass doors. I need to take a tranquilizer before I do these interviews. And I was like, what in the world? Why would you have a German Luger? I mean, it wasn't loaded. There was never any idea that it was going to be shot at anybody or anything. I was just like, wow, that's a real gun. And he said, he said that it was particularly humiliating to have your gun taken from you if you were an officer. He said he looked into this man's eyes, and the man looked at him with such joy and triumph of evil. Then he didn't say, then I killed him. I mean, it's quite obvious they killed him. I'd heard him talk about people that he killed, and I was like, why now? Why are you looking at it? And he said, I took his gun. I'm stone cold sober, and I'm sitting here feeling this. This is crazy. He said, I wanted him to see in my eyes my response to what I saw in his eyes when I took his gun. He would say, look, these aren't normal people. They're not going through a phase. This is luscious, evil, joy, triumph. They weren't normal people, you know. Now, having said that, here's a guy who's afraid to go to church. Killed a lot of guys.
Is that what you mean when you say in your book that you think that the war, like, ruined him?
Well, to the extent that he couldn't really function that well except as a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he became. You and my experience is you become a warrior, it's pretty tough to convert. You know, it's tough to look into the eyes of an SS officer on Friday and pump gas in Mississippi on Monday. It's not easy.
I'm thinking about you being a boy in your house, and on the one hand, your mother sticking your fingers into electric sockets,
yeah,
and coming after you with a knife, uh-huh, and, you know, making you think that maybe you were evil, or that
yes,
she was evil, or that there was evil dwelling in the house. You were afraid to be home, and
yeah,
at the same time, your father's talking to you about this, like, evil Nazi and who he had,
yeah,
to kill, and he still has the gun, and he has, like, evidence of that man in your house.
Yeah.
So I could see how you'd grow up.
Do you understand how he
scared.
Was haunted by?
Yeah,
he was,
yeah,
haunted,
yeah,
every night of his life by what he saw.
But I think I also hear how you were haunted by him being haunted.
Yeah.
So just to finish where we got into this from, you didn't want to do John McCain because you didn't want to mock someone who'd been a prisoner of war and had come.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, his. It was my, I mean, look, if you're injured, it changes the way you move. If you're injured, it changes the way you talk. I didn't want to lampoon someone, you know, who'd given his life.
Someone who'd been through that ordeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what really troubled me reading your book?
What?
You know, you're talking about, like, how your mother, like, physically abused you and otherwise didn't pay a whole lot of attention to you, and that,
yeah,
you know, your father was so obsessed with, like, what happened during the war, and you felt that broke him. And, like, you're having all this trouble. Like, you're at home, you're cutting yourself, you're having serious psychological problems. And it sounds from your memoir, unless you left this part out, that they didn't really try to help you. They didn't even try to understand what you were going through.
No, they never did. they were happy to accept, as I am happy to accept, a sanitized version of reality. If I can get a sanitized version of reality, I'll take it, you know? So I go to this doctor in Sebastian, Florida. The guy interviews me, and he doesn't know what the hell he's dealing with. I mean, he doesn't know. I mean, how can he in 1 hour? So he says to my mother, I mean, he says, he's a schizophrenic, and he's a manic depressive. And she, I can remember, I saw her face. She said, oh, like she thought she was about ready to get busted. And instead she's like, really? Is that right? Yeah. Well, what can we do about that? The doctor says, well, I'll just give him these pills. That's right. And then we'll lock him up here for a while and that'll be just fine. So they were happy to accept that as that's what happened. And my father doesn't know what happened at all. I mean, really, he's in his own world. And so years later, when I began trauma therapy, I called her on the phone and I said, I'm being treated for the symptoms that prisoners of war happened, Mom, but all I did was grow up in your house. Can you talk to me about that? There was a pause, and then a sort of that husky, throaty thing she got in when she was about ready to menace. She said, don't ever call us again. Click. Like that. And that I didn't talk to them until their deathbed.
Did you always remember these things about your mother?
No.
Or did they come out in...
I remember her reciting the Little Orphan Annie poem about Little Orphan Annie being butchered. I remembered that. I remember the floor being red and me bleeding in a vague sense. Not a lot about it. I remember I thought it was my fault. I remember my hand slammed in the door, again, my fault, and also electric socket, it's my fault, all my fault, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine the desperation of a child who chooses to believe that he did this to himself just so he doesn't have to consider the idea that his mother did it or his parents did it? Because, you know, Terry, I'll tell you something. I don't know anything about you, but I think it's completely barbaric to shake hands with and seek help from the person who caused your injury. That will make you sick. That's my idea. And I'm not a doctor, okay? If a doctor comes in here and goes, you know what, you're completely wrong, I'll go, yeah, you're right, I'm a nut.
You don't have any questions about these memories? Like, you're confident that your mother did this, that it's not...
Like, yes. Mm-hmm. That's the little bit that I remember, yes.
So let me say something that I think you got from your mother that was positive. Maybe the only thing, but let's talk about this thing. And that is that she really liked to do impressions of people in the neighborhood.
Yes.
And the way, maybe the only way that you had to connect with her was doing impressions too, which is how you started doing impressions.
Yes. Yes.
So... Who were those early people who you did impressions of?
We did, in those days, we were doing Ralph Richardson and Paul Scofield in a record they had of A Christmas Carol in which they played most of the characters. So we would do those words. I mean, I think I put some of that in the book. After that, as I started to get up around the age of 10, I could do a little Popeye scat singing, you know. I knew vowels and consonants then, and you know, when he was like, skeet a bit at this, get a bit, get a bit, get a bit, you know, I worked that out of my head, you know. I mean, I didn't have a lot to do, you know. So I worked that out of my head. Well, that I don't want to say delighted her or charmed her or changed our relationship. I can tell you that on a given day, it changed her state. When she got that faraway look in her eyes, when her southern accent fell, when her voice grew husky, I knew what was happening then. So, let's do A Christmas Carol, Mom. Or let's play, she used to play Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, you know, a wonderful piece. And we would sometimes play that. I couldn't play the whole thing. She could play the whole thing. I could just play like the first 60 seconds of it. Well, all of a sudden, the afternoon's over and everything's fine. I could remember... She, I guess she was doing someone from the neighborhood. I just remember doing that voice when she left the room. I was like, wow, I think I can do that.
So in your book, you describe how, like, you're going to do your audition for Lorne Michaels and for Marcy, what's her name?
Klein.
Marcy Klein, who, like, first discovered you at a club and thought, like, let's give him an audition. And you're already taking lithium for the problems that you're having.
Right. And you can see that bloat in my first White House Correspondents' Dinners, yes.
From the lithium?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, when you get the job, did you feel like, I'm hiding something from them by not telling them that I'm having these problems, I'm on lithium?
You know, if you look back in the book, I sat down in the chair, and Lorne Michaels, whose eyes don't miss things too often, I would imagine, looked at me in the eyes for a second and knew that he'd seen a creature like me before. Okay? He looked at me, a look of recognition, and he said, are you okay? Are you all right? I mean, why would he say that? I mean, I'm sure he didn't say that to everyone that auditioned for him. He knew exactly what he was seeing. He'd seen it before. And I think that when I was doing Ted Koppel in German, or Phil Donahue in Spanish, I forget, I saw him another look of recognition. And it was pleasing to him. And I did well enough that he called me back to give me another hard workout, which I did a second audition. So I was very, very honored.
So, you know, we've talked about some horrible things in your life, you know, emotional pain, drug problems, cutting yourself. Where are you now?
Well, I was on 7 meds when I was on Saturday Night Live. I'm on 1, you know, Wellbutrin, which is, I think, some of the healthiest people I know take Wellbutrin.
It's a very commonly used antidepressant.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a general principle. The point is that due to this, the great doctors I've met and some of the spiritual laws that I find miraculous in groups, look, I've been at it a long time. I don't have flashbacks anymore. I don't have nightmares anymore. I don't cut. And I feel good most of the time. I mean, I really have a nice thing going. It just took a long time to get here, you know?
Daryl Hammond's new memoir is called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed. He spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week. Country musician Miranda Lambert is on a roll. She just won her second consecutive Female Vocalist of the Year trophy at the Country Music Association Awards. And her new album, titled For the Record, topped Billboard's Country Albums chart. For the Record is Lambert's first new collection of songs since 2009's Revolution, which won Album of the Year prizes from the Academy of Country Music Awards and the Country Music Association Awards. In the time between the release of those two albums, Lambert married country singer Blake Shelton and became one of Nashville's most prominent stars. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Lambert is still not a typical Nashville country act, as For the Record proves.
The weatherman says rain today. We'll saddle up and be on our way. What's a little rain to a high-riding rebel or two?
For the Record, Miranda Lambert spells it F-O-U-R to emphasize that this is her fourth album, is a transitional collection for Lambert. Her preceding three played up the idea of Miranda as a good old gal with an explosive emotional streak. You saw it in titles like Kerosene, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and Gunpowder and Lead. For the Record is an album whose subtext is all about coming to terms with the expectations of her audience, and her expectations for herself as a performer wanting to broaden her subject matter, to work in more varied styles.
I cut my bangs with some rusty kitchen scissors. I screamed his name till the neighbors called the cops. I numbed the pain at the expense of my liver. Don't know what I did next, all I know I couldn't stop. Word got around to the barflies and the Baptist.
My mama's phone started ringing off the hook. I can hear her now saying she ain't gonna have it. Don't matter how you feel, it only matters how you look. Go and fix your makeup, girl, it's just a breakup running.
Miranda Lambert reaching for some common ground between country music and Kurt Vile on Mama's Broken Heart. If the lyrics hew to Lambert's well-established rebel girl image, the salient line here is, sometimes revenge is a choice you gotta make, its beat and rhythm aren't your standard Grand Ole Opry fare. Neither are the power ballad moments on another song, Safe, or the pleasantly intricate wordplay that Lambert navigates on All Kinds of Kinds.
If the words and who went and fell in love with that Horatio, the human cannonball. A wedding neat the big talk tent with Barker's clowns and elephants, sideshow and the oddities and all. The dog-faced boy howled out with joy as the tattooed lady was crying. Ever since the beginning, to keep the world spinning, it takes all.
For the Record contains the lowest number of Lambert compositions per album. She wrote 11 of the 12 songs on her debut disc, 8 out of 11 on her second album, 11 out of 15 on Revolution. Of the 15 songs on For the Record, Lambert wrote or co-wrote 6, 7 if you buy the so-called deluxe edition. Combine this with the more uneven quality of this album, and it is tempting to think that Lambert hasn't had the time or inspiration to keep up with the pace of her career. But the thing is, in country music, it's unusual for a star to write the bulk of his or her own material. Nashville is a songwriter's town, and Lambert has excellent taste in picking songs to cover. If anything, the ones she didn't write here work best at burnishing her strong woman with wit image. I'm thinking of the revenge-themed Mama's Broken Heart and the Gillian Welch-Dave Rawlings composition Look at Miss Ohio, with its more in sorrow than in joy refrain, I want to do right, but not right now.
Oh, me, oh, my, oh, would you look at Miss Ohio? She's running around with her rag top down. She says, I want to do right, but not right now. I'm going to drive to live out this fantasy, running around with your rag top down. Yeah, I wanna do right, but not right now.
Lambert is careful to cover a certain number of bases. There's the album's first single, Baggage Claim, that plays with the idea of carrying dead weight as a metaphor for an exhausted romance. She even ventures a little avant-garde with the fuzzed, filtered vocals on a number called Fine Tune. On the other hand, there's a duet with her charming husband, Blake Shelton. Someday, I hope soon, those two will record a duet album in the grand tradition of Tammy Wynette and George Jones. In the meantime, Lambert seems determined not to settle too comfortably into her stardom without stepping on a few toes, even if they happen to be those of her fans.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Miranda Lambert's new album called For the Record. Coming up, actress Kirsten Dunst talks about her starring role in the new Lars von Trier film Melancholia. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest Kirsten Dunst has been acting since she was a child. Her films include Interview with the Vampire, the Spider-Man movies, Bring It On, and Marie Antoinette. Now Dunst stars in the new Lars von Trier film Melancholia. Her performance won Best Actress at this year's Cannes Film Festival. In Melancholia, Dunst plays a woman getting married at her sister and brother-in-law's estate. She's expected to be happy, it's her wedding, but she's increasingly overcome by depression, and her state of mind is reflected in the cosmos, A formerly hidden planet named Melancholia is on a collision course with Earth. Her brother-in-law has a telescope that helps them watch it, but soon it's so close you can see it with your naked eye, like a second moon getting larger as it approaches. Terry spoke with Kirsten Dunst earlier this week.
Kirsten Dunst, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about the opening shot of the movie, which is on your face. And you're looking very kind of sad and maybe disoriented. Your face almost seems uneven. Your eyes are out of focus. One almost seems higher than the other. Your lips, like your left side, looks a little higher than the right side of your lips. And then leaves start falling in slow motion alongside you. And it just, that's the opening shot, and with this Wagner music behind you, it just establishes a mood immediately of melancholy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what it was for you, what it was like for you to do that opening shot?
Well, first of all, there are birds that were falling out of the sky.
Oh, those weren't leaves, those were birds?
Yeah, they were birds.
I missed that. That's really gloomy, isn't it?
yeah, leaves are kinder. They naturally fall. Yeah, I remember that day. And we had to do a couple times because they slow it down. So, you know, you had to...
Right, this is, not this only, is all in slow motion, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Not only did you have to worry about blinking and things like that and too much, but you had to worry about acting too. But yeah, I was in a headspace throughout the entire film.
So your character, Justine, is very depressed. And there's this planet that had formerly been hidden called Melancholia that's heading toward the Earth and may or may not strike the Earth and end life on Earth. And the movie seems to be saying in a way that depression is like the appropriate position to have in this world because, you know, it's reflected even in the cosmos. There's this planet named after sadness, you know, that's headed our way and going to destroy us. So people who aren't depressed just aren't in sync with the planets. They're not in sync with reality. They're not in sync with the cosmos. The cosmos is saying, be sad.
Really? I don't know. I feel like, to me, when the marriage of the Justine's depression and melancholy, it almost revitalizes her in some strange way. So I always thought of it as something, you know, really hopeful for Justine, like she came from that planet and that she's, that's her mother Earth coming to get her.
Your sister in the movie, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, when she realizes that the end of Earth might be near, she panics, whereas you feel like, yeah, it's fine, you know, it's the way it's supposed to be. And you're depressed, and she's, I mean, you're kind of naturally depressed, and she's in a panic. And so, like, the movie was almost saying to me, okay, we're going to die. You have a choice. You can either be depressed or you can panic.
Right.
Be depressed and accept it or panic.
Well, Lars always, he would say to me, I think Justine has strength at the end because when you're depressed, you're numb and you're fearless to, you know, major tragedies. So you can be the one that can take care of everyone else. So I always imagine, for me, Justine getting this strength from melancholia and almost having a sage-like quality towards the end.
Yeah,
she's not very nice to her sister, that's for sure. She's not consoling her or comforting her in any way. And there's kind of an evil... almost about Justine to me, towards her sister, but also strangely calm and kind of pulling everyone together at the same time.
One of the paradoxes in the movie is that your character is feeling kind of dead inside, not able to experience joy even at her own wedding, but your body is just luminous and sensual in spite of the deadness you're feeling inside. There's a scene where you're lying naked in the grass or on a rock. I forget which. It's a kind of long shot. And it's as if you were sunbathing, but bathing in the light or dark of this planet Melancholia that's heading toward Earth. But it's like a classical painting. Can you talk about how that was composed and how you and Lars von Trier talked about that and the kind of, you know, painterly image that you're supposed to look like?
Well, first of all, I knew that I was going to be naked in this movie at some point. You know, it's a Lars von Trier movie. I knew I wasn't going to get away without being naked. But I didn't know exactly how it was going to look. I was also stuck on the rock, so I had to be kind of rafted over. They were on a bridge above me. And listen, I knew our DP was great and very intuitive as well, because he was always carrying the camera and would have to follow us around, and we barely knew what we were doing or where the camera was half the time. We didn't really rehearse. We just shoot it right away, the rehearsal, and so we kind of figured out where we were, and then the camera would just follow us around. So I didn't know. I knew for the shots in the beginning of the film, you know, how they looked, because we'd see playback and they were very carefully composed. But I didn't know exactly how the nudity would look. I knew that it would be beautiful. Lars, you know, was like, don't worry, darling, don't worry, darling. So I knew that I was in good hands, but I didn't know exactly how pretty it would look. So it's not a terrible way to display one's body.
Lars von Trier has a reputation for putting his leading ladies through extremes, sometimes mm-hmm. sexual extremes. Did you have any reservations about working with him when you signed on?
I have to say, I didn't. I was so ready. You don't get to work with, you know, whether you like von Trier's movies or not, he's considered one of the, you know, great auteurs of our time. And, you know, to be able to work in one of his films to me was such an amazing opportunity. You know, I feel like he loves this reputation of being this torturer director, but I couldn't have had a more lovely experience. And I was also, you know, if he had been difficult with me, that would have been an experience as well. I would have had a month of that. But I still worked with von Trier, and I'm tough, and no one, you know, I would have just fought back. But I also don't think you can get the performances you can without being a teammate with someone, you know. I think I'd shut down if somebody would be cruel to me or anything like that. That doesn't work. That's just bad manipulation, and Lars is too intelligent for that.
You know, it's funny. One of the things Lars von Trier is famous for is co-writing the Dogma Manifesto, which is a film manifesto that creates rules that you're supposed to follow. So, you know, shooting must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in. The sound must never be produced apart from the images, or vice versa. In other words, all mm-hmm. the sound has to be coming from an actual source, like a radio or an iPod. The camera must be handheld. Special lighting is not acceptable. And I'm thinking, like, Melancholia violates, like, everyone in those rooms. I mean, after all, it's about a planet that doesn't exist in real life, and he has to shoot this planet that doesn't exist. So he has to create lighting and effects, and mm-hmm. and it's such a really beautiful-looking film, and a lot of that beauty is from the way, like, you are so exquisitely lit, and the way the sky is so exquisitely lit. So do you think of him as having kind of torn up the manifesto at this point?
Even though it's not following those rules, there's still a quality of that naturalness with the camera, and we have the very setup shots, but then the rest, it feels very natural to me, and the way the camera moves and just follows whoever. And it does look beautiful, though. I mean, even Lars would say, you know, this is too pretty, and what am I doing? I think that he was just in a good mood and wanted to, you know, he was in a very good place when he made our film.
That's funny, because it's a film about depression.
I know. Well, I'm sure it was cathartic for him to write it, probably, too, and experience that and come out of it on the other side.
Okay, so at the Cannes Film Festival, there's a now famous press conference where you, the other actors of the film, and Lars von Trier are fielding questions from journalists at Cannes. Mm-hmm. And he starts digging himself in deeper and deeper and deeper with one of the answers. And if you don't mind, I just want to play part of his answer, because you were sitting right next to him during this. And in fact, during this, we'll hear you.
Do I really have to relive this, Terry?
do you mind?
No. I mean, if it makes for good radio, sure, why not?
It does, believe me.
I know. I'm nervous. Oh, God. Okay, play it. Let's see what it sounds like.
Okay, and so this is his answer to the question, can you talk about your German roots and your interest in the Nazi aesthetic?
The only thing I can tell is that I thought I was a Jew for a long time, and was very happy being a Jew. Then later on came Susanna Bier, and then suddenly I wasn't so happy about being a Jew. No, that was a joke. Sorry. But it turned out that I was not a Jew, and even if I'd been a Jew, I would be kind of a second-rate Jew, because there are kind of a hierarchy in the kind of the Jewish population. But anyway, I really wanted to be a Jew, and then I found out that I was really a Nazi, you know, because my family was German, Hartmann, which also gave me some pleasure. So I'm kind of a...
Sir?
What can I say? I understand Hitler. But I think he did some wrong things. Yes, absolutely. But I can see him sitting in his bunker in the end. But there will come a point at the end of this. There will come. I will. No, I'm just saying that I understand. I think I understand the man. He's not what you would call a good guy, but I understand much about him, and I sympathize with him a little bit. Yes, not. But come on, I'm not for the Second World War, and I'm not against Jews. Susanna Bier is no, not even Susanna Bier. That was also a joke.
Okay, I think the only reaction to that is. Oy vey.
Yeah, it's almost painful just to hear it.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, we're on the radio. He's a friend of mine. It's you know, he's clearly nervous. And the woman who asked him a question asked him a kind of an inappropriate question about his mother and his mother's on her deathbed. Like, basically, that's when he found out his father, who was his father, wasn't his father. And his father was somebody else.
So that was
the question that she asked him, like, about his own mother and her death and finding out that his father wasn't his father. So I think in defense... Listen, I'm not defending what he said at all. But him being a friend and someone who I care about, you know, he is very inappropriate a lot of the time. And it's part of his sense of humor, and he kind of got in a role, and he was trying to be funny, and it was just completely inappropriate, obviously. And also then you have he's Danish, he doesn't speak English that well, you know, and he's trying to, like, make jokes, and it's just so the most inappropriate for him to do that and to say those things. But he's not anti-Semitic at all. It's just sad to see someone that you know and know so well and who's, like, has a family, who's lovely. And we all were upset with him, and it feels awkward to hear it again, you know?
I'm sure. And I'm thinking of, like, what it was like for you sitting next to him. The cameras are on you and him.
My visual is much better than that, than the voice, I feel like. It's my face just goes through every emotion possible. But, yeah, I was surprised that it became such a, like, a YouTube thing to look up, you know?
Just one more thing. At what point did you decide that you were going to try to stop him and to advise him, just, like, stop now?
Well, no one was saying anything, and I remember leaning over him. I think I said, Lars, stop, this is terrible, or something. You know, there was a bunch of us up there, and I was surprised that, you know, I knew because of my celebrity or whatever, I was the one that if I said anything too weird or anything, like, to stop him, I just was afraid to even be associated with what he was saying, and I was so embarrassed that I didn't know what to say, so I just didn't say anything. I tried to lean in to stop him, but I also didn't want to get mixed up in this conversation or him put me on the spot in some weird way, so I just sat back in pain.
Except for trying to intervene for that one moment.
Yeah, I did try to intervene, but you know, he said, you know, I have a point, whatever, I'm going to keep going.
Well, at the press conference, he was also joking about his next film was going to be a porn film, and he would get you to do revealing nude shots in it.
Yeah, forget that.
Yeah, you didn't look that comfortable during that part either.
No, because we're sitting there. It's fine if it's like with friends and he's saying this and it's funny and we're together and like everyone's laughing. But you can't say this stuff in front of a room full of press. You know, he just says what he wants to say and, you know, he went too far and he then the whole next day was dedicated to him apologizing and explaining himself and so, yeah, I feel like I'm done talking.
Yeah,
about
enough
this.
With that. Me too. Enough, yeah. Enough with that. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kirsten Dunst, and she's starring in the new film Melancholia. She won the Best Actress Award at Cannes Film Festival for this film, and it's directed by Lars von Trier, and she also co-stars with Charlotte Gainsbourg and Kiefer Sutherland. You started acting as a child. How did you get into the business? How old were you?
I was really little. I mean, I was probably 3 or 4, and I would do child modeling. At first, it was just like once in a while for fun and put money away for college, and then I tried out for a commercial for Kick Cereal, and I booked that. I had fun, and I seemed very honest in what I was doing and not someone who was forced into it by their parents, and it kind of had just a natural progression.
Since you started acting when you were so young, when you were a child and you were doing commercials, was there ever a period where you thought, that's not me anymore, it's not really what I want? And you broke away from that and tried to do something completely different.
You know, I've definitely gone through phases in my life where I stopped and had to think, okay, what do I want to be doing differently? And I loved doing the Spider-Mans because it always gave me a bookmark for what was coming up every couple years. And that was very comforting to have, like, those 3 movies to always know you're going back to that. And then when I didn't have that anymore, too, it kind of opened up another world for me. And, yeah, I think with any job for anyone and going into your 20s and people change jobs or it evolves what you want to do. And for me, acting kind of refreshed in a way for me, and I approached it differently and I thought about it differently. And I think that just comes with maturity and just getting older.
Kirsten Dunst stars in the new movie Melancholia. You can hear more of her conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.